This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, episode number 771, 771. Thank you so much for joining me today as we continue to look into the future. And I think we've got a pretty good crystal ball over here. I don't know. We shall see. I have been right about a lot of things, wrong about a few, for sure. One of the big, giant things I've been wrong about. There's really only a few things when I've made my predictions over the years. And, you know, if you've been listening for the last 700 and some odd episodes for the last 12 years, then, you know, you've heard. And on Flashback Friday, you can hear me make a lot of wrong predictions and a lot of right ones. So that's kind of a way to hold myself accountable, is to republish those old episodes. And gosh, I tell you, some really amazing things are happening, and I think it is going to be a very, very interesting time coming up here in the economic and real estate market landscape, for sure. Definitely, definitely very interesting. You know, one of the things that's kind of interested me is this idea of, can we hold in our mind and evaluate separately and together? Our minds are incredibly complex. You know, if you listen to any of or read any of Michio Kaku's work, don't ask me to spell that, by the way, but he's got this great book about the human brain or the human mind and how it's quite possibly the most amazing mystery in the universe. And if we look at it, you know, can we hold two seemingly contradictory thoughts in our mind at the same time concurrently and evaluate them concurrently, separately, and together, right? And so I think that is one of the real signs of intelligence and good critical thinking skills, if you can do that. So you've heard me talk about the three dimensions of real estate over the years, and there's really more than three dimensions, but hey, that sounds good. It's catchy, right? Three dimensions. We mostly think in, you know, one-dimensional, two-dimensional, and three-dimensional. Of course, there are more dimensions than that to time, space, and the time-space continuum, and there are more dimensions to real estate than three. But when I talk about that three dimensions, as you've heard me talk about over the years, one of the concepts that is kind of seemingly counterintuitive to many people and very frustrating, and I'm going to give you a real-life example of this here. In an email, I'm going to read you an email that one of our local market specialists sent me. Now, I don't know the exact date of this email. It may have been from a few years ago. I'm not sure, but it really doesn't matter because the concept is the same. It applies to the three dimensions of real estate. How when you go through a cycle and prices drop, rents can actually increase. And when you go through a cycle where prices are skyrocketing, rents can soften. Imagine that. It seems like it would be the other way around, doesn't it? But if you think about it more deeply, you've got people that are coming out of the rental market and into the home owner market, into that pool. They're switching from one pool of renters to being homeowners. And if there are fewer renters, well, rents are going to soften. And conversely, the opposite is true. If you have a market where it's very difficult to obtain financing and prices are declining and there's no urgency to buy and everybody's worried about the future and consumer confidence is low, then they just usually rent. And as they rent, there are fewer people leaving the renter pool as the population is increasing at the same time. And so you see rents go up in a down market. So here's this amazing email, right? This email, it's a little bit crazy, okay? And this is an actual email from a tenant. And I don't think it was in one of our clients' properties because he would have said that, I'm sure, when he sent me this email. It is in a property that they manage, right? Their management company that has, you know, several hundreds of properties under management. And it's just a really interesting email because the tenant sounds pretty entitled and the tenant sounds kind of like a know-it-all. And they obviously don't know it all. And whether they're right or wrong, it doesn't really matter because Mr. Market, as Bill Bonner calls it, is always going to have the last laugh on all of us, right? Tenants, owners, everybody. You know, we're all just little pawns in the big game of Mr. Market. Even the government and every government throughout history and every government around the world is a pawn of Mr. Market. Try to circumvent Mr. Market, as Bill Bonner calls it, and you will always lose. Now, it may take some time to lose. You may think you're winning for a while. Hey, look, the Soviets kept it up for about 7 decades, right? It obviously didn't work, but they kept up their trying to circumvent Mr. Market with their idiotic idea of communism, right? And that never works. So here is the email, and I might paraphrase a little bit of it or make a snarky comment here and there, too. It says, I agree to renew for another, this is the tenant speaking, okay? The tenant is saying, I agree to renew the lease for another 12 months, but before I sign the lease again, I would like to negotiate the rate. I did mention in my email to you yesterday that when I moved in, this property was valued at over $110,000, but it was sold in June for $78,000. But I was still paying the rental rate of a $110,000 house. Since the value has dipped to $78,000, the rate I'm paying is about twice the mortgage payment per month. Now, you know, the tenant has some kind of not so great grammar here, so I'm just trying to read it as accurately as I can, okay? The mortgage payment on this property is around $450. Well, I don't know how they know that. They're just making an assumption because they really probably have no idea how the owner financed it, whether they had a fixed or adjustable rate loan, what the term was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, whatever. Anyway, that's what they thought. So if I renew for 12 months, I would like to negotiate a rate that's more suitable with the property value, and that's $900 or $850 per month. There are some other vacancies in the vicinity currently available. Some are even 3 bedrooms for around $900 or lower. I have a friend in the real estate business, and he advised me to bring this issue up with the management. I would prefer to stay due to the hassle of moving, but if I can find a similar or better place with a lower rate, I would consider moving. By the way, the property on, and I won't name the street just to protect privacy here, has been vacant for over 8 months at the time I moved in, and I asked the neighbors on both sides about it. I have been a good-paying, responsible tenant spelled incorrectly. It is also to the owner's benefit to have someone like me living here and paying rent and not let it go vacant. We just have to figure out what's best for both parties. So, you know, I sort of want to pick at that email and kind of make fun of it, but it's an attempt to be reasonable. Obviously, the tenant has to negotiate on their behalf. Makes perfect sense. The owner replies back, I do not want to change the rent price. She can move if she wants. Thanks. I just love that. And it's just funny. Obviously, the tenant does not understand the 3 dimensions of real estate, because many times, and if you look throughout the history of various real estate markets around the country, and I'm sure around the world. You know, these are not U.S. things. They apply worldwide. The concepts are the same. The principles of free market economics are the same no matter where you go, even in communist countries or socialist countries. The market always wins out. And that's the deal. But you see what the tenant was trying to do? They were trying to argue that because the value of the property was lower, that they should pay a lower rent. So, you know, maybe this was during the Great Recession and the tenant moved in during a peak and then the property value went down. I don't know, maybe there were some disrepair issues. You know, there's just too many things I don't know here. But this email, I found it to be rather interesting and just had to share it with you. Because that concept of being able to hold multiple thoughts, seemingly and sometimes actually contradictory thoughts in one's mind at the same time, and to be able to evaluate them, are a sign of, I believe, good critical thinking skills. And let me tell you, folks, if you look out into the world, and I'm sure all of you listeners with good critical thinking skills, which are probably the vast majority of you, have noticed this, because you wouldn't be listening to the show if you didn't have good critical thinking skills, right? But if you look onto your social media feed, or you watch the news, and especially in the political arena, it is just mind-boggling the absolute lack of ability to think critically about issues and to express those ideas. Let me just share one quick example with you. How long are we going? We got an important guest today. You know what? I'm going to let this one wait, but it's about smoking. Yeah, smoking cigarettes. And the seemingly contradictory ideas I'm going to share with you, and by the way, just understand this, I'll do this on a future episode, I find smoking to be disgusting. I am going to share with you, though, some of the advantages, yes, I said that, of smoking. I do not smoke. I think smoking is disgusting. I have certainly put a few cigarettes in my mouth in my lifetime, and I felt it was disgusting when I did it. You know, usually when I had a drink in the other hand, it, you know, you get kind of stupid when you have alcohol, right? At least I'll speak for myself. I get kind of stupid when I have alcohol sometimes. You know, maybe I ought to do a show where I'm drinking sometimes. You know, I've only like done that once, I think. That'd be kind of fun. Then I'd say something really stupid and you'd all stop listening and then you'd write me negative reviews, or maybe you'd like it. I don't know. You can just give us some feedback on that, and why don't you vote on it? Anyway, but I'm going to share with you in a future episode some of the real-life advantages, I'm not kidding, of smoking. And I hope nobody takes up smoking, because I think smoking is just repulsive. It's a terrible habit. My mom smoked for the better part of 25 years, and she got hypnotized. When I remember, I was a teenager when this happened. She went to a hypnotist 3 times. Paid $75, $25 per session, adjusted for inflation. It'd be a little more now. But in either case, it was a bargain. And she quit smoking for life. And she was a rather militant smoker, I'll tell you. But yeah, you'd think that smoking is all bad. Can you hold 2 contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time? Are there some actual advantages? Well, see what you think. And I'm just going to tease you with that one, because we've got a really good guest today, Jordan Goodman. We're going to look into the future again, because that's what we're doing a lot lately. I mean, we do that always on the show, but we're looking at it in the future as we're talking about the new presidential administration, what it means for real estate investors. And that's what we're going to do today. Be sure to go to jasonhartman.com, get your tickets for our upcoming Meet the Masters event. It's going to be phenomenal. Be there or be square. This is going to be the best Meet the Masters ever. It's shaping up to be just completely awesome. And that's in Irvine, California, in January, the day after the presidential inauguration. And jasonhartman.com/events. Get your tickets ASAP before we have the next price increase. And join us for our annual, it's only once a year, Meet the Masters of Income Property Investing. Meet the Masters of Income Property Investing. If you have been before, then I'm sure you already bought your ticket, probably, because we have tons of repeat clients. But if you haven't been, it's really important for you to come. You know, we need some new people coming. Meet our clients, meet the people who are actually building nationwide investment portfolios. Have lunch with them. Sit over a table and just chat with them and find out what they're doing. And you will make it more real for yourself by doing that. That is one of the best parts of conferences, of meeting people in person. This is a great conference. It's only once a year. So join us. Go to jasonhartman.com/events and get your tickets today. And let's get to our guest, Jordan Goodman, the Money Answers Man. Quite an interesting discussion I had with him, very lively. And we're going to talk about what real estate investors can expect and what investors in general can expect out of our new presidential administration. Here we go. It's my pleasure to welcome Jordan Goodman. He's America's Money Answers Man, and he's the author of 13 books, here to talk to us today about what we can expect in our new presidential administration, what it means to real estate investors, and maybe a few other topics regarding mortgage equity optimization and so forth. Jordan, welcome. How are you?
Great to be with you again, Jason.
Good. It's good to have you. So, gosh, everybody is wondering, what is next? There has been a political sea change, and it's extremely significant. It's the, you know, probably the complete opposite of what we've had for the past maybe 16 years, maybe more than that, maybe the last 24 years. I don't know. What are your thoughts about what we can expect in the economy, what real estate investors can expect and what they should be doing? Just give us your broad thoughts first.
Dramatic change all around, Jason, in many, many different ways. Everything we've done the last 8 years under President Obama is pretty much going to be reversed, I think is the right word. So we can go through some of the areas. Taxes. So tax rates are going to come down, both at the corporate and individual level. So for corporations, they're going to come from 35%. They're proposing 15%. It might not end up at 15, but 15 to 20, something like that. Certainly a lot lower, which obviously affects real estate people because they're in many cases running their real estate business as a corporation, whether it be a subchapter S or subchapter C or however they're doing it. So their taxes should be dramatically lower. And big corporations, the same thing, which means that they're going to have more money to invest, to expand, to buy back stock, to increase dividends, just a lot more money from the corporate sector in the private sector. And then on the individual side, individual rates are going to go from currently 7 tax rates down to 3. The proposal is 33, 28, and 12. It may change, but something like that. Again, putting a lot of money into individuals' pockets, which they can invest, expand, spend, do all kinds of good things with it. So dramatic change from the past where you've been raising tax rates and taking money out of the public sector and putting them to the private sector, all of which is extremely good for real estate. So that's clearly one of the big changes coming.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, that all sounds great to me. It's surprising that people are so upset. Why would they be so unhappy about this? You know, if everyone's taxes go down, who's going to complain about that? What is the counter argument?
Well, everything is reversed because now the Democrats are going to become fiscal hawks. Republicans are loose spending ones because this, at least in the short term, could definitely increase the deficit. I mean, there's no question about it. If the government's bringing in less money, at least in the short term, and spending the same amount or even a little bit less, the deficits could go up a lot, which would push interest rates up, which has already happened to some extent. So I guess that's the counterargument to lowering taxes so dramatically. But I think in the long run, if it works, and this is a grand experiment in supply-side economics, if it works and we get economic growth of 4, 5, 6% instead of 2% where we've been, then the revenues that will come into the government will more than make up for it. And it, as they say, it'll pay for itself. That's the hope anyway.
Right. Because, and this is what people on the left just can't get their head around. At least my perception is the concept of the zero sum game. It's not a zero sum game. When you reduce taxes, I mean, it just makes common sense. When you reduce taxes, you will naturally increase economic activity. You'll increase the velocity of money. And the hope is, although it's all a matter of degree, but that ultimately the government actually increases its revenue by lowering its tax rates.
This is true.
It's counterintuitive, and you got to wait for it a little bit. But yeah, go ahead.
Just to give you a simple example, people move out of California into Nevada, because taxes, in fact, there are no income taxes in Nevada, and there's a lot.
Jordan, are you talking about me? That's exactly what I did.
I know. But there's a lot of people like you, Jason, that have done exactly that. When you raise taxes too much, as has happened in California, you drive people out and you have less economic activity, and you drive them to places like Nevada, like Texas, like other places that have lower tax rates, and you increase economic activity. So that's a dramatic example.
New York is very good at driving people to Florida.
Exactly.
You're a New Yorker, so yeah.
So hopefully, I mean, people say this is sacrilege. It's like, how can you lower taxes and have more government income? But it's happened four times in the last few decades. President Kennedy in 1962 lowered taxes from 91% to 70%, if you can imagine these numbers. And that caused the economy to boom in the 60s. In Reagan, in the early 80s, he lowered tax rates at that time from 70% to basically 50% and capital gains to 28%. The economy boomed in the 1980s. In 1997, President Clinton lowered capital gains rates from the time 28% to 20%, and that caused the boom, which was the internet boom. And then in 2003, President Bush lowered tax rates, bring capital gains down to 15%, and other rates coming down. The economy boomed from 2003 to roughly 2007. So those are four examples of how this has worked. And the tax cut that Trump is talking about is bigger than all of those combined. So this could be really fuel a lot of economic growth, which of course is good for real estate. Real estate does well and there's economic growth.
No question about it. It's, you know, they say that and this is a really old statistic because I remember I was interviewed on TV about this years ago, that the average home buyer spends $15,000 after they buy a home, right? So you know, it's a lot more now, I'm sure. And this was in the 90s that interview took place. So, you know, there's a huge stimulus effect that happens and just a huge amount of really investment because
this is what the economists call it, the multiplier effect, right? So it's not only you buy the home, but you need carpeting and TVs and furniture and all the things that go in it.
Got to redecorate.
That helps big time. Now, so that's one thing is lowering taxes. Also lowering regulation relating to real estate, for example, in the financial area.
Oh, Dodd-Frank, yeah.
Dodd-Frank has really, really slowed people's ability, people completely creditworthy people, to get mortgages, small business loans, and so on. So if we ease it up even a little bit, not repeal it, but ease it up.
Jordan, Dodd-Frank is the most frustrating piece of legislation in my world ever. I mean, yeah, Obamacare has been a disaster for me. Health insurance premiums at my company have gone up 35% since Obamacare. But I don't care. That's not that big a deal. Dodd-Frank, if Dodd-Frank would be softened or repealed, it would be just a giant boon for the real estate industry. Now, here's the thing, though. I want to ask you, you know, there's also the business cycle, right? You know, you're a believer in the business cycle, I'm sure, right?
Well, we've had a very long economic growth period here. And so it's actually better for Trump to be coming in with the wind at his back instead of Obama coming in 2009, staring in the face of a depression. So it's going to be a lot easier for Trump to stimulate an already growing economy compared to turning it around, as Obama had to do.
Right. But if you look at the business cycle, you know, it typically goes, I mean, depending on who you're talking to, about 7 years, right? And so that would indicate that just by the business cycle alone, we're due for a downturn. Because that cycle, you know, things are hot for a while, and then they have to cool. Inventories build, you know. So, I mean, there's a whole dynamic there that's a complicated discussion. But timing-wise, it would indicate that we're in for a slowdown. But, you know, here's the thing about the business cycle in this time around. And I know that, Jordan, these are the famous last words of every investor. This time it's different, right? So watch out for that kind of thinking. Yeah, we've heard that and it's a dangerous way to think. But maybe it is different this time in the sense that we're coming off of such a low. I mean, the baseline during the Great Recession was so low. I mean, it was the worst economy in seven decades. So to say that we've had a booming economy for 7 years is a bit misleading, in my opinion. I think
it's been booming, but it's been growing. I mean, we've been on the upcycle, but I think the policy changes can really overwhelm this theoretical business cycle. And when you get a big stimulus about the tax cuts we talked about, regulatory cuts, reforming Obamacare is going to be very stimulatory, reducing Dodd-Frank, as we talked about, all these things I think are going to overwhelm the business cycle. So I wouldn't just say, oh, it's been 7 years, so we have to have a downturn. I think we've had the downturn in many ways, not only here, but overseas. I mean, places like Europe are really weak. Japan is really weak. The worldwide growth has been very, very slow for a long time. So I think we've had our weakness. If the U.S. can get going, as we've talked about, and have 5-6% growth, that becomes the engine for economic growth around the world. And the world needs an engine right now.
Right. No question about it. What about trade policies? And what about, you know, to your prior comments, before you even get into trade, but it's totally linked up to my next question for you. Is Trump inflationary? I
think he wants inflation. Yes.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we've had deflation in many cases. We've had oil prices that were $100 a barrel that went down to 30. You know, now they're maybe 50 something. But oil prices have come down, and most commodity prices have fallen very sharply the last few years. And that is deflationary, not only domestically, but particularly internationally. All the countries that had been doing well in 2010, 2011, 2012, because of commodity prices going up, like Australia, Chile, South Africa, Brazil, all these places have been really, really hurt the last 2 or 3 years as commodity prices have fallen sharply. Particularly because China has slowed down so much. They've got massive overbuilding in China, and they need fewer commodities. So that's been the deflationary cycle, which not only Trump, but I think central banks around the world want to break. In Italy, in Europe, they want at least 2% inflation. They don't have it yet. They want it.
Oh, of course they do. The inflation is a fantastic business plan for countries that are fiscally irresponsible, which is virtually the whole world, practically, and for central bankers. They all love inflation. It's an excellent business plan. And Jordan, that's why I always say that investors need to align their interests with the most powerful entities the human race has ever known, governments and central banks, with standing armies, because, you know, we can complain and argue philosophy about inflation and John Maynard Keynes till the cows come home, but the fact is they're going to do what they're going to do. And I say align with them.
I always say don't fight the Fed, right? This is a classic.
Right, don't fight the Fed.
And that's true in real estate, that's true in stocks and other things. So one of the things that's clearly come out of the change with Trump being elected is interest rates, which for the most part have been falling for 30 years or more, have risen sharply, and I think will rise much more sharply in the Trump years. Everything we've just talked about, the economic growth, think of interest rates as the price of money. Okay, so when there's more demand for money, the price goes up, which is what's happening.
Of course. Yeah.
Interest rates, the long term, the 10-year treasury had been about 1.5%. It's now up to about 2.5%, a little bit more than 2.5%. That's a pretty big move in a short period of time.
Oh, sure. It's really only the second real increase in about 10 years,
right,
too.
But so, I think it's going to go higher. Now, there are good reasons and bad reasons for interest rates to go up. This is a good reason. It's because of economic growth and more demand for money and more investment, more growth, more building, all those kind of things. That's good. Like in the late 70s, when Paul Volcker came in the early 80s,
He did it to break the back of inflation.
That was he had to raise interest rates, but that was a bad reason to break the inflationary cycle. So we got interest rates up to 20 something percent. It worked, but that was very, very painful. So this is a positive way. And it's been interesting. The stock market has been soaring, even though interest rates have been going up. I mean, a year ago, when I told you the long treasury was going to go up from 1.5% to 2.5%, you'd think the stock market would have crashed. Now it's been going up because, that's a sign. And also the Federal Reserve, having raised rates another quarter point, they'll be raising it more, maybe three times in 2017. That is a sign of confidence in the economy. So it's all positive.
Sure is, yeah. So is that a preemptive sign that they believe inflation is coming and they want to cool the economy? You talked about it being like the price of money, which I love that metaphor, by the way, and it's accurate. But, you know, dive into that a little deeper. Like, why did the rates go up?
Well, think of it this way. If we're driving a car, which is the economy, Trump is putting his foot on the accelerator while the Fed's putting its foot on the brake at the same time. I think the accelerator is going to be more powerful than the brake because we have interest rates that are still extraordinarily low, even though they've gone up a little bit here. I mean, the Fed funds rate, which the Fed controls, recently went up from half a point to three quarters of a point. So we're still even below one. Even if they move rates up three times, as they talked about in 2017, that would still bring us to 1.5%. So we're not talking about double-digit rates or anything very high at all. So slightly, the way the Fed thinks of it is normalization. That's the word they use. They want to get rates back to normal rates. When we're at zero for these last 8 years, that's kind of emergency levels, which we needed in 2008. But the economy is a lot better than that now. It doesn't need such extraordinary low interest rates.
Do you have any insights or opinions on how Donald Trump and Janet Yellen see things and how they get along? I haven't heard or read much about that at all. Really, if anything, you know, will Yellen support the stuff Trump wants to do, or will she fight him? You know, it's important that a president and Fed chair get along if the president wants to achieve his goals, right?
I don't think they're going to get along too well. And Yellen's term runs out, I think it's March 2018, and there would be a new Fed chair announced in September 2017. And there's already two vacant seats on the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, which makes interest rate policy. So Trump is going to have two of his people on the policy board anyway, and I think it's highly likely that come September he will not reappoint her, and he'll put in somebody, you know, much more to his liking. So I think they'll get along okay. I don't think he'll replace her before then, but I think come the time when he has the chance to do that, he'll definitely replace her.
So here's the thing about Trump. You know, Trump is an outsider. He's a business person. He's our first real estate president, at least in modern history, at least from what I know. I just love that idea. I mean, listen, I don't love everything about Trump. I have been very critical of him in many ways. I mean, he says a lot of stupid stuff. He seems reckless to me. That kind of stuff concerns me. But although it's quite entertaining, I must admit, you know. And,
yes, it is.
Yeah, well, apparently.
But the voters overlooked all that, Jason. You know, that was not important to them. They wanted economic growth. They want taxes. They want the pie to expand. And they looked over all the other crazy stuff.
And so do I. And listen, I was not a supporter of the criminal known as Hillary Clinton. Okay, for sure.
So she would go the complete opposite direction.
Oh, of course.
Raise tax rates. Yeah. All about redistribution of income instead of creating more income.
Yeah, soak the rich. Jordan, you know, listening to you, it sounds like you're a Trump supporter or at least a conservative, or you lean to the right. But how is that possible in New York? Do you have any friends?
I do have friends, but you have to be kind of very cautious about
Trump. You have like three friends, right?
You have to just kind of downplay it, particularly in journalistic circles. You can really get in trouble if you know, sound, unless you're hanging around Fox. But it's okay. I'm okay. I believe in my principles, and I want what's best for the country. And we've been in a malaise and a low growth period for quite a while. I want to have higher growth. I want more people employed. I want to have the stock market go up. I want to have housing come back. I mean, we're in a better market, but we're still not even building enough homes to feed the population right now. I mean, there's something like 2 million. New families being created every year, and we're only growing at 600,000 or 700,000 new homes being built. So nothing close.
And that deficit is worse than you even point out, because a lot of the housing stock becomes obsolete.
Right.
You know, so it needs to be replaced because it just gets old. Although houses are surprisingly durable. I mean, you can live in them for hundreds of years.
We lose them to old age, and we lose them to storms and tornadoes and hurricanes and things too. So. We're right. We need even more than that just to replace what we've got for the population. So
absolutely. So that deficit is
all
huge.
All these things we're talking about will stimulate housing demand. And we talked about the multiplier effect as well. So this is all positive for economic growth.
Very true. Very true. So here's the thing I want to ask you about Trump. When I made those remarks a few minutes ago about him being a wild card and reckless and so forth, it's sort of easy from what we talked about already to say, oh, well, Trump is a supply sider. You know, he's like a Reagan, Arthur Laffer type guy. But then again, he seems like a bit of a Keynesian, too. I mean, he wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, which I'm not really sure that's needed. I think at least in terms of highway infrastructure, I don't think we need too much there. That's going to change a lot.
This is the first time, Jason, we're ever going to have a combination of supply side and Keynesian at the same time, because the supply side effect will be major with everything we've talked about with lower taxes and regulation. And I think he's definitely going to do a major infrastructure spend. It may not be a trillion. It might be $500 billion, but it's going to be a lot. And it can be financed. People ask me, well, where's the money going to come from for this? We have over $2.5 trillion being held overseas by U.S. corporations that they do not want to bring back here because of the tax rate of 35%. If that tax rate is cut to maybe even 10% or something like that to repatriate these monies, there are already plans to have companies put that into an infrastructure bank, give them tax breaks, and fund the infrastructure that we need. And I do think we need tremendous investment in infrastructure in our airports and our ports and our roads and bridges and all these things that have been neglected for so long. And that's going to cause a huge boom in not only the direct building of it, but the engineering and the concrete and everything that goes into it.
The multiplier is unbelievable, of course. You know, and that's, it's interesting that that's what, Obama promised us with all of his green energy initiatives that became scandals and just complete waste of money and all of the shovel ready, it was just like one lie after another. It's unbelievable. So, Jordan, I can't help but think we are in for a real economic boom. You didn't even have to mention, and we didn't talk about it yet, but when we talk about immigration control, I think we're going to see, if we finally, for the first time in decades, control our borders, as evil and racist as that may sound, we're going to see real wage growth in the lower end jobs. You get all these socialist idiots like Bernie Sanders out there who, well-intentioned maybe, but just doesn't understand how the real world works and how businesses react to things. They don't just sit there and take it. They react. They automate. They downsize. They don't
like
expand.
When they raise the minimum wage $15. Right. So restaurants automate.
You don't need to raise the minimum wage. Just let the market forces naturally occur, and you'll see higher wages. And then you see how Trump just won the Rust Belt. I mean, all of these typically Democratic union people, auto workers, whoever, right? It's unbelievable how they finally realized that the Democrats left them. They keep talking about them, but nothing's happening, And so I think we're going to see higher wages. We're going to see real wage growth for the first time in a couple of decades, even inflation-adjusted wage growth.
I think, Jason, we are going to run out of workers. I really think so. I mean, if all of what we've talked about, the infrastructure spending, housing getting going, repatriating all this money, the stock, I mean, all these things, I mean, officially we're at 4.6% unemployment. It probably is actually higher than that. But
of course it's higher.
I think there's already the Labor Department puts out a report every month, which is called the JOLTS report, or Job Opening Long-Term Survey. It's currently at 5.6 million jobs that are open, but they cannot find the workers to meet the criteria that are needed for these jobs. That's going to go to even bigger records, I think. I mean, part of what Trump has to do, and politicians can do, if they can get people trained for the jobs that exist, which is not happening in many cases now.
That's what I wanted to ask you.
Is
there any slicing and dicing of what types of jobs those are? Because if you listen to any of the tech execs, they're going to say, we need more visas so we can recruit engineers from India. Is that true? Or what types of jobs are those?
Yeah. It is absolutely true, because we do not create enough computer science and coding people here and people who can write apps.
We
need
this country is so messed up. It's just so appalling to me. We need more STEM degrees. We need science, mathematics, that kind of stuff. We don't need quite as many philosophy majors or, feminist studies majors. I mean, I haven't seen anybody hiring for those positions, but
But you're right. So that's part of it. It's computer STEM kinds of jobs, but also manual things like plumbers, electricians, tool and die makers. All those people in those jobs now are retiring. They're baby boomers in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and they're retiring. There are not enough young people going into those. You try getting a plumber today or something, and there's a shortage of these people. So that's a huge opportunity if we could get people trained, whether it be through community colleges or technical schools or somehow, for all these jobs that exist, that's a big upside for all these unemployed people who need jobs and all the companies that need to hire people. They were on the campaign trail. I remember there was a guy in Wisconsin who stood up at one of these sessions, I think it was with Trump, and said, I have 200 jobs. I cannot find anybody qualified to, you know, it was like a machine tool company or something. How do I find people who can do these things? You know, so this is a major problem, which I think could be solved and would, again, stimulate the economy big time. And these are higher wage jobs, too. These are not jobs at all.
Those are $30 an hour, maybe $40 an hour type jobs, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. With benefits. So, yeah. And another area I'll tell you as far as jobs is oil and gas. Okay. Because we have all these reserves. We've got the technology now with fracking and shale oil and all that. Because of environmental and other regulations, not having federal lands be accessible, that's all going to open up as well. And if we could truly become energy independent in this country, which creates a lot of high-paying, high-wage, high-benefit kinds of jobs.
And ultimately, it's going to be better for national security. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, so we don't have to be dependent on all these people that hate us, Iran, Venezuela, Libya, and so on. Yeah.
So well, I think Venezuela is going to come around pretty soon. You know, it's they've had a tough go of it for sure. So the part we didn't talk about, though, is we didn't talk about trade. I mean, Trump is a protectionist. He wants to institute tariffs. Are you kidding, Jordan?
Well,
I think that's kind of radical, isn't it?
It's a negotiating ploy, frankly. He does not want to put 35% tariffs on, but he wants to get better deals than we've had. I mean, with China, I think he's right that they've been manipulating their currency and keeping it lower than it really should. I mean, it's the second strongest economy in the world, and their currency shouldn't be as low as it has been. That's been giving them an advantage.
Right. So let's just make sure the listeners understand why they're doing that and what the thing is. You know, whenever you want to increase your exports, you want to devalue your currency. You devalue your currency, all your goods look cheap abroad. So China has been artificially devaluing its currency, right?
For many, many years. I mean, they have limits on how much it can go up. If there were no limits, it would be much, much higher than it is now. But they keep
and down. This is what we call, like James Rickard's book, this is what we call a currency war.
Correct. But when they've been winning that currency war. In fact, the U.S. dollar has been soaring to 15-year highs since the election because as our interest rates go up, our dollar is more attractive. But it makes it harder for our exporters because our goods are much more expensive in dollar terms. So that's one thing. Is they can, the official
but
term
here's the difference, though. Okay, we can consume our own goods inside our country, so we can have a much more closed system. We can afford to do that if we actually start making our goods again, which we haven't, you know, overall in quite a while. But China doesn't have its own consumer class yet. Its consumer class is very small compared to the U.S. being the world's largest economy and the largest middle class economy.
Right.
So we have a huge, I mean, 72% of the entire S&P is consumer goods, right? That we're buying. And
yeah, China is very much an export-oriented country, an industrial as opposed to consumer. I mean, they're getting more. I was in China.
Well, yeah, they are. They're going in that direction.
They're going in that direction, but they still have a long way to go. But
it's going to take a long time.
Also, everything else that China does, like intellectual property and pirating things and trademarks and all that, and then they put all these restrictions on American companies when they go into China that the Chinese have to control it and all that. I mean, it would be a miracle if Trump could reverse even half of that and get a more even playing field. And the only way he's going to get that is by having a threat, a credible threat with some leverage, which is the tariffs. He doesn't want to do them, but hopefully by using that a little bit of carrot and stick, his stick is the tariffs. Maybe we'll get a better deal with not only China, but Japan and Mexico and all kinds of other places where we have huge deficits that are to our detriment.
Yeah, yeah, the trade deficits you're talking about. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Jordan, what else do you want to say? This has been a fascinating discussion. You know, what didn't I ask you or just what else do you want to share with our listeners before you go?
One area I'd like to mention is that, I mean, you do fantastic work in helping people invest in real estate. And actually doing it and getting out and flipping homes. Some people just want to do things passively and they just don't want to spend the effort and everything that you teach them how to do and you show them and you make it really easy for them. But some people.
And let me make that clear. We're not into flipping over here. Our investors are all the buy and hold type.
Yeah. But so, what you do is great. But I'm just saying for some people, want to be completely passive and don't want to actually buy homes that are rental homes, there are solutions out there. And one thing that I'm involved with is a fund which does commercial real estate lending over a short-term time frame, and you get an 8% yield paid monthly, I mean 8% annual paid monthly. And then when the properties that they're lending to are sold, you get a piece of the profits as well, so an additional 2% or something like that, completely passively with a $5,000 minimum and no commissions.
So it's typically like the typical deal with a preferred return, and then you have actual equity in the deal?
Well, they don't. I would call it profit sharing. They don't actually own. They're lending to the developers, but the developers, when they sell the properties, share some of the profits with the fund. That's the way it works. So the fund is not an equity owner, but they share in the profits when the project is done. That's the way it does. There's a website people can find out about it, which is commercialrealestateincomefunds.com. And they've also got a phone number, 888-444-2102. And for a lot of people who have a lot of money in bonds and utilities and REITs that are getting killed as interest rates rise, here's a way of getting an 8% yield, and there's no market fluctuation. Minimum hold time is 18 months. So that's something that might be good for people who want another way to get into real estate without having to be experts and be completely passive about it.
Jordan, what do you say about the, like one of the things I talk to my listeners about all the time is my 10 commandments of successful investing. And number three is thou shalt maintain control. So, you know, that the crux of that is, and I know we've talked about this before, so you probably know what I'm going to say, but I just want to tee it up for the listeners, is be a direct investor. And yes, that entails a little more effort, a little more responsibility. I totally get it. And we try to make that effort and responsibility a lot easier for our people than just going out and doing it yourself. But the three problems you leave yourself susceptible to when you invest in a fund or any type of pooled money investment is, number one, you might be investing with a crook. Number two, you might be investing with an idiot. And assuming they're honest and competent, they take a big management fee off the top for managing the deal. You know, how do you address that type of thing?
Let's do the first two first, and I'll be glad to. The first one is, in this particular fund, I know the people very well, and they've been doing this for 35 years, and they have tremendous integrity, and they really know what they're doing. They've got a long-term track record of expertise and producing results. So they're not crooks, and they're not stupid. That's the first thing.
We got past the first two hurdles.
As far as the fees, the way it works for the fees is they only get paid on the back end when they produce success. So as you write, it is a preferred return, meaning the investor gets 8% before the management gets a dime. And so say, for example, the whole portfolio earns 13%, which has been their average long-term rate of return. And they're paying 8% plus, say, another 2% in profit sharing. They get the 3% on the back end after the profits have been realized. They don't get a thing up front. And they're willing to do that because they've got a long-term track record. They know they're going to deliver that. I like that.
Right. And the only caveat I want to say there, and I hate to sound like I'm being a devil's advocate, but, you know, they do probably, although I'm not sure, I'm just speculating here, but most funds do get something else because they might charge an acquisition fee, a disposition fee. They have just running the fund has fees in it without them actually getting a cut per se. What you're talking
about is
getting a cut.
I mean, for example, when they do a loan, they're going to charge points. And that's the way, so their points may be 2 or 3 points, which they get, you know, to run their expenses. Yes, there are expenses of running the fund. But I'm just saying.
Wining and dining other investors, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Is part of it, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the long run, I'd rather have an 8% return with a 2% completely passively for as little as $5,000.
You know, I mean, well, let me tell you, here's what I like about that deal. It's a short window, only 18 months. So if all the stuff we just talked about Trump being inflationary, about higher interest rates, I mean, that makes that 8% could almost be viewed as a bond, right? So in an inflationary environment or an environment with high interest rates, and a lot of times those come together, the value of the bond declines because that 8% looks really good now in a world where you know, you're lucky if you get 0.5% in the bank. But if rates go up and you can get 3.5% in a CD, then that 8% doesn't look as attractive. So at least you're not locked in for very long. 18 months is a short enough window.
Right? And the other thing is that there's no market value loss, right? If you have a treasury today at 2.5%, a 10-year treasury, and rates go up from 2.5% to 3.5%. You know, you're going to lose 15-20% of your principal. And here, it doesn't trade. There's no market fluctuation. So you get your 8%, and 18 months later, you can get your money back without any market loss. So that's a big difference as well.
Interesting stuff. Well, good. Jordan, give out your website, if you would.
Sure. So my website is moneyanswers.com. Love to help people. Lots of resources, links, videos of all types. And glad to take emails from your listeners as well. Moneyanswers.com.
Excellent. And Jordan, just closing thoughts on what is to come, what investors can expect. We talked a lot about the Trump administration, what it means. It was a very enlightening conversation. I really enjoyed it. You know, just wrap it all up for us, if you would, or maybe share anything you didn't have time to mention so far.
Well, people in this election voted for change. And we're about to get a lot of change. You may like it, you may not like it, but as we both said, don't fight it. Go with the flow. Don't fight the Fed. Don't fight the Trump direction as well. It's going to be a very exciting time. A lot of people are going to make a lot of money. And in doing good things like building housing and making people happier. And I want your listeners to go along for the ride and profit from it and not complain about it.
Good stuff. Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.